Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. The AHA wants to remind you that the Great American Beer Festival returns to Denver this October 6th through 8th. And if you want pre-sale access to the hottest beer fest in the U.S., you're going to need to be an AHA member. June 28th is the deadline to join the American Homebrewers Association to receive a pre-sale code, a $10 discount on all general session tickets, access to the member-only Saturday afternoon tickets, and first access to paired tickets. Don't delay. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to get access to the hottest beer fest in the U.S. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, June 16th, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we head to Switzerland. Well, not literally, but virtually, to talk to David Schottlander and Jonathan Claussen, founders and proprietors of the brewery Dive Bear. David and Jonathan are transplants from North America who are looking to expand their award-winning brewery. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already seen the episode we shot with Casey Letellier of Ivory Bill Brewing about his beer made with Kernza. That's the world's first perennial grain. It was a lot of fun to get together with Casey on that brew day, even though he made me clean out the mash tun. And especially fun to share that delicious beer with Steve Wilkes on the show. Hey, if my calculations are correct, this is the 800th episode of Basic Brewing Radio. We started way back in July of 2005 as a way to promote our Introduction to Extract Homebrewing DVD. Wow, that was a long time ago. And I say on the show, I thought at that time that we'd run out of things to talk about after about 10 episodes. But boy, was I wrong. It's insane to think that we've been going this long, and many thanks to everybody who's contributed content to the show over the years and to those who continue to contribute content. And a big thanks to all of you who listen and continue to go through the archives because, you know, I still get questions about shows from many years ago that, frankly, I may have forgotten about. 800 conversations after, 17 years or whatever is a lot to keep in this aging noggin of mine. So cheers to everybody. And here's to, I'm not going to say another 800 episodes, but a bunch more, let's say. We'll be taking next week off from posting the show because we'll be in Pittsburgh for HomebrewCon. Steve and I are very excited to see you all in person. So if you see us and want to say hi, don't be shy. Just come up and say hi. And we'll be glad to talk to you and see you in person and taste maybe what you've been brewing in the couple of years since we've been able to get together for one of these things. We got some fun interviews lined up already, and we'll be looking to grab some conversations on the fly, too, as we taste our way through the conference. This past weekend, I brewed a very fun beer on Sunday. Even though it was pretty hot and humid here in Northwest Arkansas, I welcomed a short brew day on that day. It was hot, and boy, apologies to those of you who are contributors, and we'll see the behind the scenes episode. I complained a little bit, but I was hot. I did a no boil extract beer using Zomba hops that I coincidentally got when I renewed my AHA membership a couple weeks ago. And I pitched a brand new yeast strain from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. As I understand it, I-22 Capri is a non-GMO hybrid. We've been talking about it I've been teasing it for the past few weeks. Now I can tell you that I-22 Capri is a non-GMO hybrid between A38 Juice and A43 Loki. That's right. Saccharomyces and Kvike getting together. We'll be talking to Matt Winans of Imperial in Pittsburgh about how they did this. I don't know how they did it, but I'm looking forward to tasting how this beer turns out. I'm expecting a lot of tropical flavors and bright citrus from the combination of the Zomba hops and the I-22 Capri. It's not available to purchase by the general public until June 23rd, but I greatly appreciate Imperial sending me a couple of pouches to play with. Pre-release-wise, Steve's interested in making a mead with it, maybe. Ask your local homebrew store to get you some I-22 Capri from Imperial Organic Yeast when it comes out here in the next week or so. You know we love Imperial. I like to say my stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches, and my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. And don't forget about their new series of videos on YouTube, on their YouTube channel, from Imperial Yeast. So anyway, this beer that I brewed this past weekend is a 5-gallon or 19-liter batch. I started off with 5 gallons of water in my Warthog electric brew-in-a-bag system from our other sponsors, Desiree and Dave of HighGravityBrew.com. I set the Warthog controller to 165 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 C, and then I added 6 pounds or 2.7 kilograms of pale ale dry malt extract. And then I started with 2 ounces or 56 grams of the Zomba at the start of that 30-minute hop stand. Remember, no boiling at all, just holding this wort at 165 degrees Fahrenheit. So 15 minutes later, after I added that initial batch of hops, I added another 2 ounces or 56 grams of Zomba. And at the end of that 30-minute hop stand, I chilled and pitched the I-22 Capri. It was hot outside, very muggy, but it was fun because of how easy it was using my Warthog electric brew-in-a-bag system. Can you imagine trying to hold wort at a rock-solid 165 degrees Fahrenheit or any temperature with a propane kettle? Forget about it. I would have been wrapping that thing with blankets and towels and quilts and all kinds of things. I used the mash mode of the Warthog controller to hold it at that temperature. Normally, I'd use the mash mode to mash, obviously, and then switch the controller over to boil mode, where then you can dial in the exact percentage of power that you want to go to your heating element. I have the Blickman boil coil in mine. But with this batch, it was basically a sous vide. So I just held it at that 165 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 C for half an hour as I did that hop stand. I love my Warthog electric brew-in-a-bag system from HighGravityBrew.com. It's taken the pain out of propane. And if you use the code EBC75BB at HighGravityBrew.com, you can save $75 off your Warthog purchase, whether it's a brew-in-a-bag system, 2-vessel or 3-vessel. It's up to you. That's at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Okay. This is a fun conversation. Let's talk to David and Jonathan of Dive Bear in Glan, Switzerland. David Schottlander, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Klassen, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hello, James. Great to be here.
You guys wrote nice and complimentary email to me introducing yourself and saying that you're longtime listeners, you guys. And yep. You have got a really fun story to tell, and you're on a journey to found to expand your brewery. And I said, well, it's a great story. I'd love to hear more about it. Why don't you come on the show? So David, why don't we start with you? tell me who you guys are, you know, kind of your background on brewing and how you met. And, you know, maybe we'll toss it over to John to kind of, you know, expand on that story.
Okay, sure. Basically, John and I are neighbors. We met through our daughters who both, and we both live in the same building. I moved to Switzerland about 11 years ago, and John's been here for almost twice that. And at some point he said, "Hey, Dave, why don't you come into my kitchen? Well, I'm bringing up some beer." And that's how it started. I think it's how a lot of home brewers tend to start, even larger breweries. And from there, we just, at some point, we decided, well, why don't we try to do something a bit more serious with this? And that's where we took it from there. So, yeah, we moved from space to space, from his kitchen to a garage at a local winery, from there to a garage at a local little industrial building, and then into a bigger space in that same building. And then we found ourselves wanting to move out, and we had a space lined up. So we sold off our equipment. We had a 200 liter system, which is probably about 50 gallons. We sold that off and then found out that we couldn't move into that new space. So we were left sort of homeless. And that's where the latest chapter, not the latest, one of the past chapters of our brewery began.
Kind of a saga. It's a saga. Yeah.
A long one.
There will be a conclusion, or maybe
it's the continuing story.
Exactly. 8-part TV series.
And John, tell me about your brewery. What's the name, first of all?
It's called Dive Bear, which when you read it in English, it looks like the dive dive bar, really. But the bear is spelled in German, so the B with the umlaut over the A and the R. David and I both actually grew up, I'm from Minnesota, and he's from Quebec. So we have real-life knowledge of bears, and we had seen this bear diving into a lake or a river, and we were like, you know, Dive Bear, why not Dive Bear? So we took that name, and we had a great artist in Canada who was able to fashion, or, you know, half mermaid, half bear. So David, being the wordsmith he is, was clever enough to come up with a story about a legend, which he may tell at some point during this conversation. But the idea about Dive Bear is just, you know, playing on different words. We're about having fun, experimenting with different kinds of styles. There's really no limits, just like the bear who is curious enough to go into dive into the water, discover some good beer down at the bottom of the river. We're the same in our philosophy, I would say, about brewing.
So first of all, I guess you may be the first people I've talked to living in Switzerland and brewing in Switzerland. So tell me about, Dave, tell me about the beer culture in Switzerland. Is it kind of a crossroads?
Sorry, I think we're at a point in Switzerland where there's a huge number of breweries in Switzerland. I think we have the greatest number of breweries per capita of any country.
Wow.
There's a lot of small breweries. Of course, there's the few huge industrial size breweries as well. But there's quite a shift, I think, towards people are starting to appreciate craft breweries a lot more. But there's still mainly production breweries are still fairly small, and a lot of them come up to this point where we were not long ago, where you can grow slowly but surely up to a point, and at some point you have to just say, well, either we invest a lot of money and time into making a jump to a much bigger system, or we give up or just keep doing it in our garage to entertain our friends. There's a growing appreciation of craft beer here, especially among the, I don't know, 20 to 35 age category, I'd say, but it's definitely growing.
And what kinds of beer styles would we find there? I assume that you're heavily influenced by your surrounding countries.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we're technically in, like, Switzerland is divided. Half the German-speaking part of the north is in the beer belt, so then you have the historical German-influenced beer cultures and style. But as you go further south, the climate gets a little bit more warm, and we're in the wine region. So there used to be something called the beer cartel in Switzerland, where they had basically partitioned up the country, and each brewery had the right to sell in a certain part of the country, and they were just selling their lagers, which was really they were all the same, basically, as we know, of traditional lagers that were done on an industrial scale. They can be much better, obviously, but they weren't that good. But now, you know, people really have gotten their hands around IPAs, and that's probably one of the, if you go outside of lagers, the first best-selling style, at least in the craft beer space here, is definitely IPAs. But people are just open to, once they get that taste of something that's original, something that has character, you know, all the esters and the things that we can get with craft, especially ales, then people are willing to try all kinds of things. So the sky's the limit, but it's advanced, but it's probably still maybe 5 or 10 years behind the States, I would say, in terms of where we're at.
I recently talked to a Tony Manzi in Italy, and you know, of course, you know, wine is big in Italy as well, and they have a style there called Italian Grape Ale, which integrates actually grape and grape must into the beer. Are any similar things happening in Switzerland where people are integrating sort of, you know, traditional cultures or traditional beverages or traditional ingredients into beer that is, you know, not found anywhere else?
I don't know if, John, you want to take that, but what I was just thinking about, we were just speaking about exactly that the other day with a friend of ours who makes a wine-based beverage as well, whether we could, you know, use grapes to make beer, and it is being done. I think John probably knows a bit more about what's actually going on in that department. But
yeah, people are, you know, the culture of winemaking is strong, so we definitely have access to grapes. We have access to grape juice. We also have, it's a fruit-growing region not too far away from here. So, you know, apricots are big here. Strawberries are now, it's, you know, there's lots of local growers, and there's a focus on buying more and more local. So we've done like some creative things, taking local ingredients and putting them into our beers. We've been working with some local bakers as well about experimenting with bread in making beers. But traditionally speaking, there was indeed a divide between what was made, and beer now at being at a level where we can make those experiments is something that is new. There hasn't been necessarily so many traditional type beverages made with like fusions of beer, let's say. But that's quickly changing now.
Hmm. And it would sound like with the amount of craft breweries in the area that finding equipment and ingredients shouldn't be much of an issue.
It's not. I mean, definitely we're, as the crow flies, I don't know, we're like a couple hours away from Germany. So, you know, there's loads of, we brew organic, but a lot of our malts come from Weyermann. But even in Switzerland now, the local farmers are growing barley and wheat that they're giving to local maltsters that are starting up. And it's pretty exciting. The hops, the North American hops, we still have to import, but they have all the noble hops can be grown around here. So that's a big plus for us. The water, I always like to tell people that the water underneath our feet is the same water as Evian, because we're on the Lake Geneva, and Evian is a underwater aquifer that's fueled from the melting glaciers over many thousands and probably millions of years. So we have an amazing water profile here as well to brew with. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it sounds like on the face of it, it would sound like is it a fairly neutral water profile? I mean, water from glaciers, it seems like it would be just as pure as it could be.
The water we have in our local neighborhood tends to be fairly, I'm trying to think of the word for it in English, calcaire, very chalky, actually. So it works well for stouts especially, but we haven't had any issue. I mean, actually, we quite enjoy the water we have here.
It's kind of, they take a mixture of the lake water, which is flowing directly from the snowmelt, and some of the underwater aquifers. So in Gland, we have a really nice mixture. And from a pH perspective, yeah, it's pretty neutral, so that we don't have to really do so much treatment of the water to replicate certain styles. We did have the issue when we first were brewing in a village about 3 or 4 miles from here. The water was really, as David said, really chalky, and it was minerally, and it was really, it gave us some, and at that point we weren't maybe sophisticated enough to be treating the water, so we had some less than great results with the beers we were brewing there. But in Glen, where we live, it's quite good.
And being from North America, do you find yourself leaning toward, the North American styles? Are you trying to kind of infuse, you know, some American hoppiness, say, for instance, into the local culture there?
I think a lot of people expect us to do that, just because, you know, we're from North America, and But we tend to be all over the place, literally, in the styles. We've done German styles, American, you name it, Belgian. Or the first beers we made were both Belgian. We had a Belgian ale and a Belgian wit beer. So basically, everything's possible, and we don't limit ourselves. So there are some breweries in the area that'll focus on one particular style, and that's their style. But we just, I don't know, that's maybe me because I get bored easily. I just like to do everything.
I think I would say, James, we bring the North American style of breaking the rules in a way, like not being scared to, you know, try things and maybe not have a great result, but we're not scared to, you know, experiment, let's say.
Yeah, I think a lot of our ideas just come, like the way I come up with beer recipes or ideas for beers, just I was eating Black Forest cake. I said, this would just make a fantastic beer. What can we do to, you know, to make that happen? And we came up with a beer that was called Schocke, which is also, it's the Swiss German word for hot chocolate. Mm. And it was quite a nice beer. We thought so anyway. Some people just thought it was horrible, but we thought it was quite good at the time. So the ideas just come from anywhere. And, you know, we don't, I'm always looking for new styles to brew. So I do look for classic recipes that are out there. And like, you know, the next one, one of the next beers that we want to do is a New England IPA. So I've been testing those out in the market myself just to get a better sense of what they should be like or can be like. And I'm not very happy with some of them, but I digress. But my point is, yeah, just I think we try a bit of everything. And like John said, we have this attitude that you can, there's no limit. You're not going to be limited by the Reinheitsgebot, the, you know, the purity law of 500 years, exactly 500 years before we launched the company, strangely enough. So yeah, there's no particular rules that we won't break if we can get away with it.
Yeah, every time hazy IPAs are mentioned on the, you know, in an interview on the show, I always joke that, you know, hazy beers are going to kill the craft beer industry. and then the brewers that brew them and sell them are saying, well, our customers don't think that. Yeah. So is it getting hazy over there?
Not yet so much. They're coming. I think they're coming. That's kind of where we're at. If you measure probably where, when the hazy IPAs or NIPAs started to become really popular and you look at that year, we're probably there. That would give you a sense of the time differential between Switzerland. So it's definitely there. They're starting to come in. People definitely love the IPAs. They like the aromatics. We've actually experimented, and we did a really popular beer called the Abruti, which is it's kind of, in French, it means a jerk, but it's a play on words for a brute IPA. Mm. So people were loving our classic IPA we were brewing, but often they didn't enjoy the bitterness because they hadn't developed a part of their palate to appreciate it. So we brew a beer called it's basically very little residual sugar, loads of dry hopping, but we don't even put hops in the boil. We just put a little bit of hops at in the whirlpool. Mm. And it turns out to be a very drinkable and really refreshing beer.
Yeah, it sounds like you're on the road, you know, because the New England IPAs, you know, it's not so much about the hot side, but it's, you know, it's about the you know, just post boil and the dry hopping and yeah, really leaning on the cold side for the hop character. Is it difficult, you know, of course, with the information superhighway, you know, we all get information around the world, but is it difficult? Do you feel in any way out of touch with, say, especially North American beer culture being over there in Europe?
Sorry, I'm trying to think. We're sort of a conduit for North American beer culture. If we see anything, if we can sort of surprise people with what we do and bring something over. But I don't personally feel that the distance these days really makes all that much difference. I think we're having probably a good influence on the local beer culture because there's still a lot of small brewers, a lot of craft brewers who are sticking to the very, I don't know, it's in France, for instance, there's the basic system where you have your ale and your wheat beer, your dark beer, your brown beer, and that's basically it. That's, or maybe a red, you know, a rousse. But we try to avoid this distinction. So by actually going by beer styles and trying to make it a much more colorful rainbow than it tends to be, I think we're sort of influencing the local area. I mean, I don't think we have that much influence on everyone else just yet, but at least on our customers, we're opening up their minds a bit and their palates to a bigger variety of things.
Excellent.
And plus, we have access to your podcast, James. So,
what else do we need?
Every week, so we're tied in. We just have a time difference, but it's true that there's a lot of beers that are exported from the States to Switzerland now, and there's some stores that you can kind of get the bigger breweries, you know, that everyone knows of. You'll find their beer, so we can get that. What we can't get, like David said, is we can't get that culture, like the tap room culture, the culture of being able to, you know, discover breweries that you can really make an event or a destination out of them. That doesn't yet exist here. That's kind of what we're trying to create. So that's where we have an opportunity, I think.
Well, cheers to you for expanding palates. I'm always in favor of that. You know, more different good beer is better than the same stuff as we've known over the years. Now you've described your operation as right now sort of a nomadic situation. Dave, where are you now, and you know, where are you brewing, and what are your plans?
Well, currently we're brewing at a friend's brewery in the next town over, which is about 5 miles away, and in another brewery, which is closer to 60 miles away. It's about an hour or so. And this happened because we found ourselves without a brewery at some point in the past, and we needed a solution to get us to where we are today, which is on the verge of opening up an actual brewery, 1,000-liter system, which is, I guess, 250 gallon.
Yeah, it's like a 7-barrel, I would say.
Yeah. So we're about to set up shop right next to the train station in our little city here. There's a vacant lot that the city has offered to let us use. And so the idea is to set up shop in a bunch of shipping containers. So we'll have a brewery, a tap room, restaurant, coffee bar, the whole works in one spot. And that's where we are finally after 6 years of sort of aiming for this sort of thing. We had a few setbacks in the past where we had another project in a huge restaurant that we were going to convert, but then COVID happened and that was the end of that. Mm. So that's where we're headed at this point. John probably has the color to that.
Yeah, John, tell you, your structure, the actual physical structure of the establishment it looks pretty innovative to me.
Yeah, we won actually a prize 2 years ago for a circular economy like prize, because we presented what we wanted to do to the city, and they're like, oh, this looks great, because we're trying to really bring everything together. It's really tough to do. Maybe that's why not so many people do it, but we want to bring together the aspects of local, so sourcing as much as we can locally with some sustainability in terms of how we use water, how we, you know, try to be as economical as possible with the water usage. We're going to try to put some solar panels on the roof to generate some renewable electricity when it's sunny. Switzerland generates about 65% of their electricity from hydropower. So by definition, it's kind of a renewable, as long as the glaciers are still there, it's a renewable resource that we can use. And we're trying to basically take our values that we have anyway and put them into practice in creating a business. So big barrier to entry. You know, Switzerland is one of the most expensive countries in the world. So that's what always is challenging when you're of little means as we are. But to overcome that, we've created like an LLC type structure. So people can buy shares in the company, and that's how we're working on financing the big amount we have to raise.
And in the, talk about the actual structure of the building.
Yeah, we wanted to do like initially we thought, we can do these there's loads of these shipping containers around. And we spent a lot of time researching that. And what we found out is that there's also the Swiss requirements for insulation and that we have to adhere to. So retrofitting a shipping container was expensive. So we ended up finding this company. They're still containers, but they're typically used for school kids when they have they have too many kids in a school. So they put these containers there. So we found a company that is going to sell us these used containers that used to hold maybe kids in their classrooms. And we're going to buy 12 of them in all. And 4 of them will be the brewery. 4 of them will be the restaurant space. And then we have like a cold room, a small kitchen, bathrooms, and like a technical kind of space for the electrical units and those kind of things. So it's we brought together like the local architects. We've got loads of people helping us because it gets pretty technical when you're trying to bring in electricity and you know, hook it up to these containers, which typically are set up to have lights and those kind of things. But a brewery is a bit more demanding in terms of the electrical needs. So.
Yeah, a word of warning to anyone who thinks setting up shop in shipping containers is simple, easy, and cheap. It's not. It's quite the opposite, in fact, what we found. Unless you're doing something temporary, like a little shop that's going to be there for a week and then that's it. But if it has to last and keep people warm in winter, forget it. It's just not as easy as you'd think.
And so it sounds like you're going electric as far as your power source or your heating source.
Yeah, we wanted. I mean, it's true that from a purely cost perspective, gas would be cheaper. Although now, you know, we are in Europe, so gas prices, as you know, are rising here for some reason. Mm. But yeah, they do have the bandwidth and electricity to do it with electricity through the local provider. It's going to cost us a little bit of. It's going to be a little bit expensive in the setup because there's an introduction fee we have to pay. But as we get rolling, it should be fairly. Doable. So we're going to go, in any case, go that route.
And how would people find out more about Dive Bear? And, you know, if they want to become involved in helping to get you guys off the ground, how would they find out more?
The short answer is they can go to our website at www.divebar.ch, which is Switzerland. There's also we have a crowdfunding campaign, which is just tanking. It's not really going anywhere at this point, but it's a bit harder to find. But I think we're going to have a link on our site, if we don't already have it, to the crowdfunding campaign. But or just send a message to info@divebar.ch. And that way we can send people information if they really want to invest. We do have some investors from North America, which is kind of nice. But I don't know if John wants to add something to that. But
no, we're encouraging participation at all levels. We even have a local artist who's going to, you know, decorate the outside. She's like psyched about helping us in any way she can. And as they always say, starving artists maybe don't have deep pockets, but they're loaded with creativity and goodwill. So we're excited to have all kinds of people participating in the project.
Yeah, I think that's one of the coolest things, how many people have just been willing to just help out. They see what we're doing. They say, hey, what can I do to help? Or I can do this. Can I just, you know, come by one day and help you guys out? It's like, well, fantastic. Absolutely. So it's really nice to have that sort of sense of community, which is interesting for a place that it's, you know, it's our adopted home. We're not from here, but people are just really warm and welcoming. And when they see something they like, they throw themselves into it.
Excellent.
It helps that we have a product that we can reward them with as well.
Yeah, the beer has something to do with it, I'm sure.
I haven't figured out the connection yet, but it seems that it's helping.
Turns out people like it. I've got a deal for you from our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont. They're offering you $5 off to try some tasty meads that you might not have tried before. But some are getting close to being sold out, so you might want to head over to Groenfell.com soon. Summerfest is what Ricky the Mead Maker is calling their best mead ever. Summerfest is aged for 3 years in bourbon barrels, so there's just a few bottles left. Smoke on the Mountain, you've heard me talk about, it's also in limited supply. That's the tea-based mead with Merkin chilies, black Ceylon tea, hibiscus, and lemon. Be Proud is the Pride Month offering based on cassis orange cocktail. Buckland has green rooibos tea and lemon. Great for summer. And Maple Edition, Root of All Evil, is also in short supply. That one sounds especially delicious to me because I'm partial to that ginger mead, Root of All Evil. Anyway, if you use the code TRYABREW, that's TRYABREW, you can get $5 off these meads. There's always another fun and delicious honey-based product around the corner, but if you want to get in on some of these limited editions, you'll want to hurry. Use the code TRYABREW, TRYABREW, to save $5 on each of these at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's GroenFell. I want to pick your brains. I told you before we got started that I wanted to pick your brains. I've been doing this series on recipe development, and because I think it's important. I think it's important for you know, from cooks to chefs to homebrewers to sort of have ownership of their own products, so to speak. And also, you know, once you get your feet wet into building your own recipes, you know, like I said before, you know, you more different beers means there's more good beers out there. And it kind of continues the sort of cycle of people inspiring each other to do different and interesting things. So, Dave, I'll start with you, I guess. When you first got into brewing, were you comfortable with the concept of building your own recipes? And if not, how did you get comfortable?
Well, I guess I'm lucky that I've sort of have John to lean on as a crutch, because I'll come up with fantastic ideas and say, oh, I'd like to make a beer that's kind of, you know, like this or like that. And I'll, we still use Beersmith as our go-to tool, because it's fine, you know, fairly fine-tunable. So I'll find a recipe, a basic recipe that's vaguely in the general area of what I'd like to do, and then I'll tweak it. And then John will come in and say, that's not going to work. You might want to boost this or you know, take that down a bit. So he's, I don't know, I think more, he knows more of the technical aspects of perfecting the recipes, I think. But that's how we tend to go about it, just come up with ideas. We could start with a wordplay and say, oh, this be a funny idea, let's try this. And then sort of we play tag team, where he'll just kind of have a look at it and try to work on perfecting it so that it be something decent. And we haven't had any beers really that we just brewed and said, oh, this is horrible, unless it was a mistake. Like I was listening to one of your podcasts the other day where you mentioned putting hops in the hop bag, and then when you pulled up at the end, you had nothing left in the bag. Well, that happened to us too, and we ended up with a New Zealand IPA that was green because we just had all this wonderful floating hops in it. So that's my approach to designing beers. I don't know.
Yeah, I think those were cryo hops that wound up.
Wound up, that's it.
They all went away. So Dave is more on one side of the brain, and John, you're on the other. Is that how I'm interpreting that?
The yin and the yang. I think David's got the definitely more creative than I am in terms of coming up with great ideas, like you mentioned before, the shoki. The chocolate one, which we had, actually we took cocoa beans and we put them in Kirsch, which is a local Swiss liqueur, strong liqueur made with cherries, and we put it in the beer after the fermentation was finished to get a really chocolatey, you know, aromatic, although the cherries were kind of lost in the process, they're quite volatile. But my philosophy, I think, is just balance. I'm always shooting for things that are balanced, so having not too much bitterness, something that you can drink a whole bottle of before you can maybe want another bottle when you're finished, but not having things that are too out there that you want people to understand what you're looking for, but get them curious enough that they want to have another sip of it. That's kind of something that I'd always heard both from listening to your podcasts. I read John Palmer's How to Brew when I started, and then I did some training in Belgium and France on a professional level to kind of get a few of the basics down. But I think it's nice to have someone like David to, you know, who's coming up with these great ideas. Then we can kind of work on how do we make it a reality in terms of making a beverage that we really are both happy with and proud of that we can come out with. So we're really excited because in the future we'll even have more professional equipment to experiment on and even amp up the quality, I think, to the next level.
Yeah, I think I've had so many beers that were really fun to drink either in a flight of samples or maybe, you know, a 1 ounce pour at the homebrew festival or something like that, where, you know, that was really fun and I liked it, but I wouldn't want a pint of it. You know, I'm so happy that I had it, and you know, it might inspire me to brew something, you know, similar on my own. But yeah, the drinkability of a full pint, especially, you know, when you're in business, it seems like that would be pretty important.
Yeah. We've always, you know, you have some beers that sell really fast and others that sell slower. But at the end of the day, as long as you sell them, that's what's important and people like them. And you can never please everybody with all your beers. So that's a given. I think you just, you know that there's some part of your fans that are going to really love something. But as long as you have beers that you can position with anybody that comes to your brewery and they're like, well, I don't like beer. We're like, okay, well, what don't you like about beer? Is it the bitterness? Is it the, you know, the flavor, the mouthfeel? And then you can kind of get people to find the beer that we always say, you just haven't found the beer that resembles you, which is a bad translation in English of what we say to people in French here. So we're doing pretty good at converting a lot of people, I would say, to craft beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a surprising amount of people who come by saying, I'm not a beer person because the only thing they've tried is the industrial slosh that's out there. Mm-hmm. And when they've tried our beers, they're like, that's beer. I was like, yep, it's beer. I was like, wow, okay, I'm a convert. And we take it from there. So as long as they have enough of an open mind to give something a try, then it tends to work out.
Yeah, I was saying something like, I don't like beer is kind of like saying, I don't like food. it's such a wide condemnation that covers so much that you can't categorize beer in one silo anymore. Thank goodness.
Yeah, which is great. That shows how far we've gone. So.
So, John, I mean, since you're the recipe smith, when you first approach a recipe. You know, say Dave comes up and says, you know, I want a chocolate cake beer. What are the first cogs that start turning in your brain? I mean, how do you even start to build a recipe? What are the first building blocks that you think of?
Yeah, it's evolved. I used to, when I first started doing recipes, I used to look at articles in Brew Your Own, which talk about styles and about the base malts to use, the type of yeast, hops and those kind of things. And that kind of gives you the first ideas about how to build the basis for it. And then you go from there. As things have evolved, you know, with Beersmith, you can say, I want to do this style, fine. But typically, you know, kind of what you like. And we start with the yeast. I'm really dogmatic about having high quality yeast. So we go to actually White Labs has a lab in Denmark that we order from. And we've worked with some local, they're starting to get better too locally where they're able to do some yeast strains, but we try to make sure we have the highest quality yeast. And then we do, you know, we're doing all organic beers. So we want to have certified organic products as much as we can, although we're not dogmatic either. So we'll take somebody that's growing something locally 10 kilometers away. We'll gladly buy that as opposed to importing something from North America. Doesn't make too much sense from if you're looking at the carbon footprint of things in the grand scheme of things. But I think you have a basis for what you want to do. Then you keep it balanced and you know, based on what you've done in the past, what you think could work well. You add some things, you add a little bit of, I'm not so daring. So I like to move things slowly, turning the dial up and knowing that it's going to be pretty good. And next time we can even better, but I don't want to turn the dial up too high. I don't want to go to 11 the first time and start with 5 or 6 and then get it a little bit higher as we do the recipe a second or third time afterwards.
Do you have a sort of a collection of sort of base recipes that you start out with and kind of build on top of those? I mean, do you have, you know, kind of a, you know, some recipes in your pocket that you know are going to work well? And then kind of expand and modify those?
We do actually have a few. Well, we have our a few basic recipes that we've been brewing nonstop since we started doing this. And we have used those as the basis for other variations of it. For instance, we're working with the local theater, which is one of our biggest clients, to develop a new beer. So we're basing it on one of our existing beers and just modifying it from there to be something in between kind of two of our existing beers that'll be more in line with what they're looking for. They have a fairly picky clientele. They seem to like certain beers more than others. So we're sort of aiming towards the ones that we know please them, but coming up with something completely new for them, which we'll be brewing in the next couple of weeks, actually. So yeah, we do. We have our basic roster of beers, but not entirely. We do come up with, you know, completely original recipes at some point, quite often actually, especially when we were able to brew ourselves as often as we wanted to in our own facility. Now it's not the case. So we're a bit kind of hindered by that, But soon enough, we'll be back to brewing when we want, how we want, as much as we want.
Yeah, what are your philosophies on base malts? I had a conversation with Casey Letellier over at Ivoryville Brewing Company, and he's got a very small brewery. And whereas most larger breweries in the United States, especially, you know, their default base malt is two row. You know what we call two row, which irritates some people, but just the American, you know, just American pale ale malt. Because it's so cheap and it's so versatile, is there a default base malt that you use over there, or do you tend to migrate between different base malts for different characters?
I think we're really lucky because we are in Europe, so we have access to, you know, these malt companies that have been here for hundreds of years, and they have, you know, we can typically, what we do to answer your question is we go between Pilsner and pale ale malt. But like for the beer that David was just mentioning, we're going to try some Vienna malt as a base malt because we want to have a bit of lighter character. And I've never gone over a certain percentage of that in a recipe. Now we're going to try to go up pretty high. We typically like to have also, and I learned this, I'm not sure where, maybe it was from your podcast or someone that you had on, but typically I like to have also 5 to 10% of wheat in almost all of our beers, just to give that a bit smoothiness to the mouthfeel. It's true that it creates maybe a little bit of protein haze that can hang around, but typically our beers are smooth and people tend to really appreciate the mouthfeel, I think, that, and that's a big part in addition to the flavor and the aromatics. I think that's really important. And the mouthfeel, a lot comes both obviously from the body that you have with the mash process, but also I think from the base malts that you're selecting. So the wheat is always going to be in most of our beers. But yeah, Pilsner, if we're going to do a Belgian, obviously we're going to go, you know, as much Pilsner as possible with some wheat in terms of the base malts. But then for our pale, even for our IPA, we actually have it's like 60% pale ale and 40% Pilsner, because I like having that mixture of not super complexity, but I think it does. It's nice to just mix things up a little bit and not have it so straightforward. So,
and where do you fall on crystal malts? Do you, like in your IPAs, do crystal malts play a role in you know, bringing some mouthfeel and some color and such as that? Or, you know, how heavily do you rely on, you know, adjuncts or specialty malts to kind of, you know, liven up, you know, some of the more, you know, base malts?
I think that, you know, we've done like a Scottish wheat heavy ale. We've done both imperial and dry stouts. And for those, obviously, you need to have the specialty malts. We do put a little bit of, they call it Cara Munich, which is a Carol of crystal malt. It's a Munich malt, but they caramelize in the process of the malting. So we use that in an IPA. It's when I grew up in Minnesota, there was a brewery called Summit, which was one of the first to come out with in the local area, and they called it an extra pale ale. And the color that they had was like a light amber color. And I always wanted to recreate kind of that beer. And so our private IP actually has a bit more caramel in it, because I kind of like having that little bit of a sweet backdrop to the hops, to really, once again, it's about balance. And I think that you can get that balance. It helps a little bit in some styles of beers to have some of those, but we tend not to use it if we don't have to. We're not going to put it in everything, but I think it has its place. I'm not, definitely not against it.
And are there in brewing as long as you guys have, are there sort of myths or common practices that you thought were just had to do them, you know, when you started out brewing, that now you don't follow anymore? I mean, I've got a list, but you know, are there things that you've learned over the years that, you know, that were taught as, you know, sort of the gospel or the doctrine, you know, of brewing, that you kind of have let go by the wayside nowadays?
I think probably the number one is that the way that we use hops in the hot side and I don't think you need to use so much. And the additions at different points in the boil, we don't do that. That was something I read about. You know, you have the 60-minute addition, the 30-minute, and the 10-minute before. And I was like, no, just we'll put one addition in to get the IBUs we need for the balance we're looking for. And I think we become more and more sparing in our use of hops and not having to use as much, because I think even in dry hopping, there's a lot of perceived bitterness that you get. And you don't really need the IBUs because the perceived bitterness is there already. If you were to measure the IBUs, maybe it wouldn't show up, but people can tell because the hops do bring that characteristic. So we've definitely lightened up on the way that we use hops. There are things as well. You start to wonder, you know, do I really need to boil this for 60 minutes? The things like you've done, like your experiments where you've done like the 30 minute boils and those kind of things are always making me wonder like, well, maybe we don't need to do some of these things for so long. So obviously we don't have the lab equipment today to test things. And that obviously gives you the confidence that you need when you try those kind of experiments on a professional scale. But I think you never stop learning. That's why it's kind of fun, because I think we're just kind of at the beginning, and there's plenty more to learn as we go along.
Well, excellent. Well, I wish you guys luck on the next phase of the Dive Bear. And I'm excited about use. Is it an umlaut over the A that I'm gonna be able to use in the title of the episode?
Yep. Yeah. That's it.
I might have to look up some HTML characters to before I post.
Alt 132.
There you go.
Yeah. I use it every day.
Oh, awesome. Well, it's been a lot of fun talking to you, and I hope that y'all will keep in touch. And
we will, sure.
I look forward to hearing about the next phase.
Say hi to Steve. Say hi to Steve from us too, James.
I shall.
And cool. If you plan to be in the general Switzerland area, just do stop by. We can brew a batch together. That'd be kind of fun.
Oh, you bet. I would love to. I'd love to get out of the house and travel. Thanks, guys.
Well. All right. Yes. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Well, thanks again to David and Jonathan. Again, best of luck on their new expansion. Remember to go to divebear.ch. That's divebar.ch. It's spelled like dive bar, but it's dive bear, to find out more about what they're up to. I'd love to find myself in Switzerland and tasting some delicious locally made craft beer there. Remember, next week is HomebrewCon, so we'll talk to you the week after that. Unless we see you in person, then we'll be talking to you next week. Looking forward to seeing y'all. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. See you in Pittsburgh. So long.